Whenever a law is about to be passed extending the ban on smoking in public places, the dark side comes to the fore or pulls strings from above, i.e. the tobacco industry, and argues that it's the nanny state, unreasonable restrictions on freedom, and in any case the evidence that passive smoking, being exposed to other people's smoke, is harmful is overblown. Well, evidence from research at the world-famous Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, begs to differ. The Mayo Clinic had its origins in looking after the health of the surrounding population in what's called Olmsted County, where almost everyone is treated by the clinic. So the health records are superb. Dr. Richard Hurt is professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic.
In Olmsted County, we can collect all the medical diagnoses of all people that live here over time. So we're able to do incident studies, and what that means is the number of cases of a study per 100,000 population per year, basically. So before the first law was implemented in 2001 to after the second law was introduced in 2007, we looked at 18 months before and after to see what happened to the incidence of sudden cardiac death and heart attacks.
What was the difference between the two laws?
Well, the first law was smoke-free restaurants, and then in 2007 it was smoke-free workplaces, so all workplaces became smoke-free.
And there were very few examples around the world where people did a before and after study?
That's correct. And there have been some that have been done. The best one probably is in Scotland, where they assessed the incidence of heart attacks in Scottish, almost two-thirds of the Scottish hospitals before and after the implementation of the law. And what they saw was a dramatic reduction in heart attacks.
And what did you find here?
We saw both a dramatic reduction in heart attacks and, for the first time, a reduction in sudden cardiac death. And that's the first time that's been reported.
Was the effect bigger than you were expecting?
It was much bigger than we expected. We thought we'd probably see a 20 to 25% reduction, maybe. The highest been reported thus far for heart attacks was 47%. And our reduction in heart attack incidence was 45%. And the reduction in sudden cardiac death was 50%.
It's huge. When you introduce such laws, people who smoke probably smoke less because it's harder to smoke, but also there's less passive smoking, so fewer people are inhaling other people's smoke. Have you got any way of assessing the effect here? Is it the effect on people who are active smokers smoking less or giving up, or is it on people smoking less of other people's smoke?
We think it's the latter. We think it's the exposure to secondhand smoke, and there are several reasons for that. First of all, when we assessed the percentage of smokers in both cohorts, before and after, the percentage of smokers was basically the same. So the prevalence of smoking was about the same, even though the prevalence of smoking had gone down in the overall population. The other things we were able to assess were, in the population, hypertension, high cholesterol. Both of those remained basically flat. Diabetes went up. Obesity went up. So everything was either stayed the same or it got worse. And the only thing it did change was the exposure to secondhand smoke.
Because the tobacco industry, but also others, have suggested that the effect on the heart and blood vessels of passive smoking, other people's smoke, has been overstated.
That's absolutely not true. In fact, it's probably an understated. You remember, the tobacco industry is known for creating doubt about health consequences without actually denying it. Those are their words. In fact, there's one document from Brown and Williamson about smoking and health. Doubt is our product. By creating doubt, we can create controversy. If we can create controversy, then we can delay things or get things derailed. So the tobacco companies have been instrumental in fooling the public about this for a long time. So for secondhand smoke, or tobacco smoke in general, it is a non-linear dose response.
What does that mean?
What that means is, when you think about it, a linear response, the higher the exposure, the worse it is. A non-linear response goes like this: more bad stuff with lower exposure. That's what tobacco smoke does. So lower exposure gives you very, very adverse consequences. Now it continues to go up, but it's a non-linear dose response.
And why is that big effect so quickly?
Because the tobacco smoke has so many things in it, over 4,000 chemicals, over 60 known carcinogens, and the acute effects are on the endothelium, the inner lining of the arteries, and on the platelets, as well as antioxidants, a bunch of other things. But the two main things are its effect on the endothelium and on platelets. So the platelets become sticky, they stick together, and that's what causes the thrombosis, coronary thrombosis, which is the beginning of a heart attack.
And you don't need too big a dose?
This is a nonlinear dose response. And these are the cardiac effects going up dramatically with lower levels of exposure, leveling off and continuing to go up, but not a linear dose response. The effect on the endothelium, the inner lining of the arteries, causes it to become more stiff. less distensible. So that when you have exposure to as little as 5 minutes of exposure to secondhand smoke causes the endothelial lining to become less distensible and therefore more rigid, which is not good because when your blood pressure goes up when you have a pulse from your heart, and if that artery is not able to distend, then damage can occur to the inner lining of the artery. With 30 minutes of exposure, it reduces the coronary velocity reserve in your coronary arteries to that of a smoker.
Really?
So 5 minutes of exposure causes endothelial dysfunction of the aorta, the main big blood vessel, and 30 minutes of exposure causes malfunction of the coronary arteries. So these effects are not only dramatic, they occur with lower levels of exposure.
What's the next frontier?
Smoke-free workplaces are really important, as are taxes. Those two public policies do three things. They reduce consumption in people who continue to smoke. They smoke fewer cigarettes a day. Increases the chances of a smoker stopping smoking and decrease the chances of your child or grandchild ever starting to smoke. That's why the tobacco companies fight those two laws so hard, is because it affects their bottom line. Next would be other things. In Australia, the graphic warnings and then the plain packaging, the industry is terrified of that because the identity of their product is on their package. So if it has a plain wrapper, particularly that bad-looking green that they did focus groups on to see which color was most repulsive. And if that survives the legal challenge that the tobacco companies are doing in Australia, that will be a gigantic step forward. Another area that's of interest in helping people not to start smoking, young people, is taking smoking out of the movies. What we know about this is that the prevalence of smoking in movies is higher than the prevalence of smoking in the general population, and it influences young people to initiate smoking. So those are two areas. So the graphic warnings, plain wrapping, getting them out of sight. Cigarettes should be under the counter, out of sight. In the UK, they're doing that this year in large retailers, and next year or the year after next will be in all stores. You will not be able to see the cigarette package. That's already done in Canada. So there are many other things that can be done to return us to the norm. And by that I mean cigarettes are not something my great-grandparents had to contend with because cigarettes were not a real product until the turn of the last century. Camels was the first modern cigarette, and it was introduced in 1914. So the cigarette epidemic is really a 20th century phenomenon that's carrying over into the 21st century. So as we take them out of sight, take them out of movies, lower the smoking prevalence, then that returns us to the norm, which is when cigarettes did not exist. New Zealand, on the other hand, is taking a really very, very good step forward, and that's what they're calling the end game, the end of tobacco use in New Zealand by the year 2025. They have a plan that's been a comprehensive plan that's been approved by their right-of-center government, and it's being implemented as we speak. So New Zealand is actually leading the way for the world and your region. Australia has really done very, very well, too, with the things that they're doing, particularly with the plain packaging.
And you're taking it globally.
Yes. There are two initiatives that we have. One is called Global Bridges, which is a healthcare alliance for treating tobacco dependence. It's a network of healthcare professionals all across the globe to learn how to treat tobacco dependence, but also become advocates for tobacco control policy. Most physicians and other healthcare professionals do not realize how big a voice that they can have in public policy debates. And so we're going to energize and mobilize this network of healthcare professionals to influence policy and also influence treatment at their local level, their state level, or their country level. So we've initiated that in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. We're expanding to Europe and to North America, and then Asia is looming out there as the largest user of tobacco in the world, particularly China and India. So we're rolling that out now. The other is a global smoke-free worksite challenge, which is to challenge all members of what's called the Clinton Global Initiative, which is 1,000 or so corporations and nonprofits, to make all of their workplaces globally smoke-free. Right now, there are a few corporations that do that. Johnson & Johnson would be one. IBM is one. Nike is one that have smoke-free workplaces already globally. But to do that could really influence the effect of tobacco smoke on millions of people.
Dr. Richard Hurt is Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic.